This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Y ahora es medianoche en punto. Here on WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio here in New York City. And that means that if everything goes according to plan, it's time for this. Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM.
Thank you.
Well, that was exciting. Welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City, where we're opening up with some music from the Buryat and Mongol peoples of Central Asia. That's from a record called Uragsha, instrumental and vocal music from Buryatia and Mongolia, available from Global Village Records. And that was a cut entitled Altan Galu Noyon Kuban, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I believe that was probably the name of the performer. He's a traditional storyteller performing a traditional Buryat song accompanied by the Klun Kun. Having trouble seeing in this light. Some kind of string instrument, quite evidently. So this is the story of a powerful and just Khan named the Golden Goose. And the lyrics partially translate as, "It was long, long ago. It was the good old days when the grass was always green, when the blue sky was just being conceived by the universe, when the birds first learned to sing. Yes, it was then." So this is the kind of deep traditional stuff that we love to delve into here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade every once in a while, because it always gives us a feeling of awe that that these traditions continue to survive in this hyper-globalized world of lightning-fast change and seemingly complete hegemony of the corporate monoculture. Nonetheless, these cultures continue to survive, and in some strange paradox of globalization, which is threatening these cultures, at the same time, it's also the process by which these sounds of traditional people, in this case in far eastern Siberia, the Buryat people, can actually be available here in New York City on a disc that I can play on the radio. So there you go. And the Buryats are closely related to the Mongols, and this is somewhat related to what we're going to be talking about this evening. I would like to talk about the situation in Uyghurstan. Does anybody know where Uyghurstan is? Also known as East Turkestan, also known as Xinjiang, far western China, where there was just a rather grisly terrorist attack. And consequently, the Chinese authorities have been engaging in a rather grisly crackdown since then, right on the very eve of the Beijing Olympics. And, well, the Uyghurs are a Turkic people, but their history is very closely wound up with that of the Mongols. And they were, in fact, they had their own written language way back in ancient times, and they were the original scribes and record keepers of the Mongol Empire of Genghis Khan, before eventually, of course, the Mongols adopted the languages of the people who they conquered, and under the Yuan dynasty in China, they, you know, Chinese, of course, became the official court language, and with the Ilkhan dynasty in Persian became the official court language. But before, the Mongols themselves were sort of domesticated by the people they conquered when they were still these semi-nomadic ass-kickers way out in the steppes of Central Asia and just beginning to establish their empire, which we know as at its height stretched from what is now Poland to what is now Korea. The official language of court and the official language of record and song was that of the Uyghurs. And the Uyghurs continue to have their culture alive today. And they were Because they were allied with the Mongols, they were incorporated into the Yuan dynasty, the Mongol dynasty of China, and I guess it would have been, what, the 13th century? But at the same time, they also maintained a very high degree of autonomy, which is most obviously evidenced by the fact that while the Khans in Beijing were being converted to Buddhism by the Chinese, who they conquered, the Uyghurs at essentially the same period were being converted to Islam by Persian and Turkish traders along the Silk Road. And while in the subsequent dynasties, that is to say the Ming King or Manchu and finally Communist dynasties, Communist Party dynasties, their country, which they call Uyghurstan or East Turkestan, because they are the easternmost of the Turkic peoples, but which the Chinese call Xinjiang, which means frontier territory, I believe, in Han Chinese. Their territory has remained under official Chinese rule, but has been rather restive, and just about every time that there was any possibility of doing so, the Uyghurs established local autonomy or an independent state. Most recently, in the unrest and general breakdown of central authority, which gripped China in the 1930s and 1940s, the Uyghurs established the Islamic Republic of East Turkestan, which was eventually crushed by the communists, and they were reincorporated into the People's Republic of China. But for the past 10 years or so, there's been a very strong Uyghur resistance movement, which has been emerging yet again. And I was wondering if following everything that happened in Tibet earlier this year and following the peasant unrest, which is really sweeping across China, mostly the industrial heartland around Fujian and Guangdong, where peasants are being pushed from their traditional lands by industrial development projects and by real estate speculation and all that sort of thing. I was wondering if there wouldn't be unrest breaking out during the Olympics, forcing the Chinese state to resort to rather draconian methods. Well, here we are on the very eve of the Olympics, and we shall soon see, but it looks like it is actually the Uyghurs rather than the Tibetans who are out on the front lines. And in fact, although it received considerably less attention back in March when there was the big crackdown in Tibet, there was also a lesser protest movement and a lesser crackdown in Xinjiang as well, where Uyghurs also were demonstrating for local autonomy and self-rule and being put down, not with the same degree of brutality as in Tibet, but nonetheless with considerable brutality. And there were mass arrests and so on, and hardly made the headlines at all. So we're going to hopefully take a little look at the situation in Xinjiang or Uyghurstan or East Turkestan this evening, and use that as a general springboard for the looking at the question of what does the contemporary Chinese state represent, and what should our stance as anti-imperialists here in the West and in the United States and in New York City be towards the contemporary Chinese state and the restive peoples such as the Uyghurs and Tibetans, and even the Han Chinese peasantry, who are increasingly confronting the Chinese state. So, maybe we'll hear some more of this music tonight, and maybe we'll just go over some recent current events, and then maybe we'll take some listener phone calls on these questions. But first, I've got a couple of very brief announcements. Perhaps some of you noticed that I was mentioned in the New York Times today in a story entitled East Village Before the Gentry by our good friend Colin Moynihan, another one of my Lower East Side buds, fellow Lower East Side denizen. And this is a story about a new book which has just been released by Japanese photographer Q Sakamaki, entitled simply Tompkins Square Park. And it is looking back at the 20 years after. You know, we've been just had this big 20th celebration. In fact, tomorrow, or given that it's after midnight, we could even say today is, in fact, the 20th anniversary of the Tompkins Square riot of August 6th, 1988. And there have been a series for the past 2 weekends, and I believe this weekend as well, there's been music in Tompkins Square Park to commemorate the riot. Well, Q Sakamaki has put together a book of his photography, extremely gripping photography, of the Tompkins Square riot and generally the East Village back or Lower East Side, to be more accurate, or the Lower East Side, back in the 1980s when it was an extremely sort of apocalyptic landscape. And if you pick up his book, you can see for yourselves, if you weren't around back in the Lower East Side back in the 1980s, what an apocalyptic landscape it was, and the general prevailing atmosphere of class warfare, which was shaking the neighborhood at that time. Well, where can you get a copy of the book Tompkins Square Park by Q Sakamaki, with, by the way, an introduction by me, Bill Weinberg, which is why my name was mentioned in the story about the book in the New York Times today, or perhaps we should say yesterday, given that it's after midnight, the Tuesday New York Times. You can get your very own copy of the book Tompkins Square Park by Q Sakamaki with an introduction by yours truly, Bill Weinberg, by going to the book launch party, which is going to be tomorrow, or perhaps given that it's after midnight, we should say today, Wednesday, to dispense with any ambiguity. Wednesday, August 6th, that is to say the 20th anniversary of the Tompkins Square riot, 6:30 p.m. at the Powerhouse Arena. Where the hell is that, you may ask? Well, I'll tell you. It's 37 Main Street in Brooklyn. And there's going to be a slideshow. And where the hell is 37? You know, I should know. For some reason, I was under the impression this was in Dumbo. But, you know, maybe there's a map on their website. Let me go to their website. I'm going to try to be there. It's going to be, the slideshow is going to be beginning at 7 p.m. sharp. And here, let's see, where the hell is Powerhouse Books? You can just go to Powerhouse Books.com, and maybe there will be directions on the website. Let's see. Will they, in fact, give you directions on the website? Because really, this doesn't mean very much to me. 37 Main Street. I mean, I sort of know my Brooklyn geography, but somehow I was under the impression this was Dumbo. Is this Dumbo? This is the kind of thing I should have done before I got on the air. Bookstore. Let's click on that. No, that's the online bookstore. You see, this is what I hate about the world that we live in today, is that, you know, all this information is available on the web, except invariably the information that you're looking for. And particularly anything which has to do with the real world, like getting directions to an actual geographic locale here in the meat world, in the flesh world, in the material world. Well, forget about it. You can't find that because, you know, if you're looking for information that has to do with the meat world, you're just hopelessly on hip. As we know, everything which is important is online. And anything which is not important is not online. So, all right. I don't know. I give up. I don't know where the hell this place is. Can anybody help me? Where the hell is 37 Main Street in Brooklyn? This is like utterly, directions. Here we go. Hidden away in the most obscure corner of the website. Okay, 37 Main Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11201. That's not directions. That's just, here. We've got to scroll down a little bit. That's just an address. Here we go. The Powerhouse Arena, 37. Yeah, it does look like it's, it does look like it's Dumbo. F train, F subway from York Street. Walk down the hill on J Street. Make a left on Front Street. Walk 4 blocks and make a right on Main Street. So there you go. Or you can take the A to Cadman Plaza. And walk north two blocks to Front Street. Well, there's a map here. Let's click on the map. Will the map be able to help us? At least there's a nice fast connection, so it's loading quickly. Yes, exactly. It is between the, contrary to what you would assume from the name Main Street, it's actually a tiny little street which is only a block long between Water Street and Front Street. There you go. Rather counterintuitively named street. Main Street, indeed it is, between the Brooklyn Bridge and the Manhattan Bridge, on the other side, that is to say the Manhattan side of the BQE, between Water and Front Street. That's exactly where it is. Okay, now you know. Main Street. Somebody must have had a funny sense of humor. Ha, ha, ha. Anyway, so I'm going to try to be there once again. Book launch for the book Tompkins Square Park. It's sort of like a coffee table, black and white photo book with an introduction, a history of the Tompkins Square Rebellion by yours truly, Bill Weinberg. Photos by Q Sakamaki. Tomorrow, 6:30 p.m., slideshow with Q&A begins at 7 p.m. Once again, that's 37 Main Street. I already told you where it is. And if you want more information, just go online to powerhousebooks.com. Okay, that took entirely too long, but now you've got it. All right, so one more event. Does anybody out there remember East Timor? Well, our good friends at the East Timor Action Group remember East Timor. And in fact, they're going to be speaking about it next Monday, a week from yesterday. August 18th is not next Monday. That's two Mondays from now, right? Yeah. So I'll have the chance to announce it again, but I'm going to announce it now. Monday, August 18th, 7 p.m. at Blue Stockings Books, 172 Allen Street on the Lower East Side. There is going to be an event entitled Justice for East Timor, Impunity for War Crimes, Impunity for Crimes Against Humanity and the Commission for Truth and Friendship. And the blurb reads as follows. What are the prospects for justice for crimes committed during the Indonesian occupation of East Timor? Matt Easton of Human Rights First, John Miller of ETAN, the East Timor Action Network, will discuss the recent report of the Commission on Truth and Friendship, which acknowledges Indonesian responsibility for severe human rights violations in East Timor in 1999, but also encourages impunity for those responsible for crimes against humanity. Background. Want some background? Here's some background. Background. Indonesian officials organized a campaign of terror against the East Timorese people during East Timor's independence referendum in 1999. First to compel them against voting for independence, and then, after that failed, to punish the Timorese for their decision. In less than a year, 1,400 East Timorese were murdered. 75% of the nation's infrastructure was destroyed, and hundreds of thousands of Timorese were displaced. In late 2005, Indonesia and East Timor founded jointly the Commission of Truth and Friendship, a bilateral body whose task was to determine the, quote, conclusive truth, unquote, about violence surrounding the referendum. The commission's report was given to Indonesian and Timorese governments in late July. The report found that the Indonesian military was in charge of organizing and arming the militias responsible for human rights violations. However, the commission had serious weaknesses. It deals with only the last year of Indonesia's brutal occupation, which began in 1975, by the way. The commission could not compel testimony, and Timorese witnesses were sometimes mistreated. I'm not quite sure what that means, but you can go to the event and find out. The commission could not recommend prosecutions and could have, but chose not to, recommended amnesties. Well, at least it chose not to recommend amnesties, right? The Indonesian, Timorese, and U.S. governments are all accepting the commission's findings. So, once again, this is all going to be happening. If you want to get up to speed on East Timor, which has pretty much completely disappeared from the headlines, despite ongoing unrest and violence there, unfortunately, and the whole question of, once again, impunity for Indonesia's war crimes, they are sort of being left up in the air. You want to get up to speed on East Timor, once again, that's going to be Monday, August 18th, 7 p.m. at Blue Stockings Books, 172 Allen Street. Take the F train to Delancey and walk north. And I'll have the opportunity to announce this again next week. So I'm going to announce this again next week. But, well, one question I would like to pose is, you know, once again, there are so many double standards around these whole questions of national self-determination for colonized peoples. You know, a lot of the people who were cheering on Indonesia's, East Timor's liberation struggle from Indonesia would be just as quick to deny the right of the Uyghurs and Tibetans to seek self-rule from China. Did you ever ask yourself, why is that? Well, maybe we'll explore this question shortly. But now, why don't we hear a little bit more from Oragsha, instrumental and vocal music from Buryatia and Mongolia. Here, let's hear cut 8. This is once again on the Kun Kor. I believe that's the name of the instrument. I'm going to look that up on the internet while we play this next cut. So, I should say that it is here, I'll go to the station break now. It is mere minutes, 2 minutes to be precise, of 12:30 in the morning, which makes it 12:28 in the morning in my rather roundabout way of giving you the time here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg. One more thing I want to say before we get the music is I want to really heartily thank everybody who pledged last week when we were fundraising. And I'm sorry I was such a crab. You know, I shouldn't let it get me down so much because I understand that, you know, we do ask you for your money a lot. And I shouldn't, you know, just interpret it as a personal slight when people fail to deliver. And some of you, in fact, you know, did finally come through, and we did just about break 500, which is what I consider to be the minimum goal for what's a respectable amount of money to make. So thank you very much, those of you who pledged. I really appeal to you to pay your pledge. It's very important. And it seems that WBAI, in fact, this time around met its goal. We met our goal for the fund drive, for the emergency summer fund drive. So that really makes me feel good. It makes me feel like maybe this radio station, in spite of everything, is not a completely lost cause. Maybe people really do care about its survival. So thank you. Thank you so much for everybody who pledged, either for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade or just for BAI generally. I really, really want to extend my heartfelt thanks and, of course, appeal to you to pay your pledge, because pledging doesn't help us unless you pay your pledge, right? And again, I apologize for being such a crab. The thing is that the thing about that I always found so frustrating is whenever I have to pledge, whenever having a fund drive, the tally doesn't move for the first, you know, hour and 15 minutes, and I think I'm going to go home making nothing, and I start to panic and start to get really crabby. And then in the last 15 minutes, all of a sudden it surges ahead by several hundred dollars. And I just don't understand why it happened, why it works that way. I don't understand what is the strange psychological dynamic I have with the listeners. And similarly, when we take listener phone calls, we start taking listener phone calls at 1 o'clock in the morning. And I urge people to call in, and nobody does. And so, you know, we waste the first 15 minutes just kind of farting around. And then finally, everybody starts calling. The board just lights up like a Christmas tree, and everybody starts calling and wants to, you know, chime in the last 5 minutes when, of course, we don't have time. So I don't know why it always works that way. But I appeal to people, if you want to, call in, please, you know, think about what you want to say. And call in at around the top of the hour. All right, now it's 12:30. I actually talked through those 2 minutes. So now it actually really is 12:30. And we're going to go to some more Buryat and Mongol music. Let's see, I'm trying to figure out if this cut we're about to play is Buryat or Mongol. It doesn't say. But Anyway, over the course of the next half hour, while we're going to be discussing the situation in Uyghurstan, I appeal to everybody who you know, has something to say on the matter to think about what you have to say. And then when we take phone calls in a half an hour, give us a call. Don't wait for the last 5 minutes of the show. Give us a call at around 1 o'clock or so, not at around 1:25 when we only have 5 minutes left. The number is 212, write it down, 212-209-2900. Once again, that's 212-209-2900. Now, all of you people who are calling in now, you're wasting your time. We're not going to take your calls now. We're going to take your calls in a half an hour. So hang up. Because we're going to play some more music now, but we're not taking phone calls now. Go away. Do you people really, you think I'm joking? Go away. We're not taking calls now. I know who you people are anyway. You're the usual cranks. Anyway, here we go. Let's hear some more. I don't know if it's Mongol or Buryat music, but let's hear it.
Yeah.
More from Oragsha, instrumental and vocal music from Buryatia and Mongolia from Global Village Records. Now, we're playing Buryat and Mongol music because we can't find any Uyghur music. So if anybody out there can get us some Uyghur music, we'd love to hear it. Give us a call in 20 minutes when we take listener phone calls. If you can provide the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade with any Uyghur music, that's 212-209-2900 is the number. We'll take start taking calls in about 20 minutes, I guess. Okay. So, did anybody happen to notice that there was an attack yesterday in Kashgar in Xinjiang, or Uyghurstan, in the far, far west of China? This is kind of northwest of Tibet, in which two ethnic Uyghur men were arrested for apparently assaulting with grenades a police patrol, in which 16 officers were killed. And subsequent to this, as you can imagine, there's been quite a crackdown in Kashgar, which is actually quite a large city of several million, but in a very, very remote part of the world, the most remote part of China, way, way, way out there on the western deserts up against the Tian Shan Mountains, near the borders with Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And the Chinese authorities there are claiming that this is part of a conspiracy to turn 2008 into a year of mourning, quote-unquote. That's M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, of course, and to disrupt the Olympics. On the part of the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, or ETIM, and allied organizations, including the East Turkestan Liberation Organization and the East Turkestan Independent Movement. And there's been a sort of a general crackdown with police carrying out house-to-house searches and putting up roadblocks all over the place, asking people for their IDs and carrying out preemptive arrests and detentions of people who were suspected to be linked to or sympathizers of the ETIM, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. Which Amnesty International has protested. Quote, the Chinese authorities have the right to protect the life and security of their law enforcement officials. However, attacks such as these should not be used to justify the promotion or implementation of repressive or abusive security measures. Now, it's very difficult to get out the information about what's actually happening to the indigenous Uyghurs who live there, but two Japanese reporters were roughed up and detained by the Chinese security forces after they attempted to photograph the scene of the attack, and the Chinese authorities have issued an official apology about that. Let's see. Then just about, about a week ago, was it? July 21st, in southern China, southwestern China, in the city of Kunming, there were two bus blasts, which killed 14 people during the morning rush hour. Very bad news indeed. Chinese authorities are also blaming this on the ETIM, although nobody's claimed responsibility for it. And there is speculation that, well, I mean, this is very, very far from Uyghurstan. This is nowhere near Uyghurstan. This must be, several hundred miles away at least, maybe even 1,000 miles away from Uyghurstan, to the south in the city of Kunming in Yunnan province, which I believe is up against the border with Thailand and Laos, if my geography does not fail me. So there's speculation that it might have had to do with local land disputes. and peasants being angry about losing their lands. And this is something which is happening all over China, and it's been happening, as I mentioned earlier, it's been happening a great deal along the Pacific coast, which is the most heavily industrialized part of China, around Fujian and Guangdong provinces, and also in Manchuria. But it's starting to happen. There's been similar episodes in Yunnan as well recently, where the lands of the peasants have been sort of, through these unscrupulous deals, have been privatized and taken away from the peasants and sold off to private developers for sometimes, you know, even for real estate development, you know, for these like garish McMansions for China's nouveau riche elite, or sometimes, you know, just through bureaucratic fiat, you know, we're taking this land for an industrial project for the betterment of the nation, et cetera, et cetera. And peasants have taken up arms against the authorities over this. Not firearms so much as just taken up, you know, farm implements, their hoes and machetes and whatnot, and mixed it up with the local constabulary. And now there is speculation that some of these angry, disenfranchised peasants may have even resorted to terrorist attacks in Kunming. Still, to the best of my knowledge, nobody has claimed responsibility for the Kunming blasts. So, definitely one to watch. Let's see. A couple of Uyghurs were executed back in mid-June, this would have been. Mid-July, right. In other words, just before the Kunming blast, actually. Chinese authorities in Xinjiang executed two Uyghurs and sentenced 15 others accused of terrorist ties. They were summarily executed upon their conviction. Immediately executed upon their conviction on July 9th. There's the date. Most of the rest received prison terms ranging from 10 years to life. All were charged with being members of the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, or the ETIM, not, mind you, of actual, you know, terrorist actions, but merely of being members of the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. Now, a particular irony, which I will point out about the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, is that back in 2002, when the United States, when the Bush administration, was attempting to line up Chinese support for a United Nations resolution authorizing military action against Iraq, one of the things which the U.S. did to try to win Chinese support was that they put the ETIM, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, on the official terrorism list. So now the ETIM is officially a designated foreign terrorist organization, according to the U.S. State Department. Well, of course, ultimately, the U.S. gave up on trying to get U.N. approval for the Iraq attack, and they went ahead and did it unilaterally through their own coalition of the willing, quote-unquote. So having to appease China no longer was an exigency after that, and China and the U.S. quite notoriously, you know, fell out. And there's been a great deal of tension between the two recently, as we're aware. But ETIM remains on the State Department list of foreign terrorist organizations. And the and the U.S. has actually been using this, the Pentagon, in fact, has actually been using this as a justification for keeping so-called enemy combatants, Uyghur enemy combatants who were detained in Afghanistan, keeping them incarcerated at Guantanamo Bay. Okay, there's a little irony for you. I hope some of you will get that irony. So let's see. There was a case that actually went to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit last month in July. The case of one Huzaifa Parhat, who was a Uyghur from Xinjiang, China, who was detained in Afghanistan by U.S. forces and has been held in at Guantanamo Bay ever since, and has been designated an enemy combatant, quote-unquote, by the tribunal system, by the Combatant Status Review Tribunal, which has been established at Guantanamo Bay. And the U.S. Court of Appeals last month overturned this decision, labeling Huzaifa Parhat an enemy combatant, claiming that here I'm going to actually read from the judge's finding. U.S. Federal Judge Merrick Garland ruled that Parhat, the detained man, has made a credible argument that at least for some of the assertions against him, the common source is the Chinese government, which may be less than objective with respect to the Uyghurs, unquote. So wrote Judge Merrick Garland. And the basically the court ruled, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ruled that either Parhat is going to have to be released or transferred to a third country or to a civilian prison and actually charged in the civil courts, or else there's going to have to be a new tribunal convened to review his charges. So we're waiting to see what's going to happen to Huzaifa Parhat. There's certainly, a great deal of irony here. I would hope that people are not, that the irony of this is not lost to the listeners, right? And okay, the U.S. and the State Department have, on one hand, they've tried to groom certain dissident Uyghurs, and in fact, Bush has met with some prominent Uyghur dissidents, just like he's met with the Dalai Lama. But at the same time, they're also, actually using the findings of the Chinese intelligence services as evidence against the Uyghurs who they're holding at Guantanamo Bay. Have designated, the ETIM, they're claiming that this Huzaifa Parhat is a member of the ETIM, which was designated a terrorist group entirely on the basis of the claims of the Chinese state. There have been 22 Uyghur detainees at Guantanamo Bay since 2001. Most of these have judged to have never been a threat to U.S. national security and are now either slated for release or have already been released. But because there's a great deal of concern that if they are sent to China, they're going to be facing torture at the hands of the Chinese state, much as we can assume they already face torture at the hands of the U.S. military at Guantanamo. So human rights organizations have been calling for them not to be released to China, which raises the question of what do you do with them? And Afghanistan obviously does not want them back. So some of them have been deported to, of all places, Albania. Albania actually agreed to take in some of these Uyghurs. And the rest, it's kind of up in the air. It's uncertain what's going to happen to them. And the ones who are in Albania, are they going to be, exiled from their homeland forever? It's a very interesting question. But, for all of the ostensible tensions between Washington and Beijing, there's an obvious point of convergence here. And they're obviously, at least to a certain degree, de facto allies in the so-called GWAT, the Global War on Terrorism. And, there have been periodic rebellions in Uyghurstan throughout the centuries, as we noted earlier. There was, let's see if I can find his name in this book which I brought, entitled China's Minority Nationalities, edited by Ma Yin, which is actually published in Beijing. And they've got a chapter on all of the minorities of China. I'm looking at the section of Northwest China, which has got sections on the discussions of the Uzbeks and the Tajiks and the Shibes. And here is this the Kyrgyz and the Kazakhs. And I'm trying to find the section on the Uyghurs. Here we go, the Uyghurs. So there was, for instance, back in the 19th century, there was an Islamic uprising, which actually spread beyond Uyghurstan to other Muslim minorities in China, which was led by a Uyghur warlord named Yaqub Beg, which, according to this book, was... And again, this is a book which was published in by the Foreign Language Press in Beijing, China, in 1989. So again, not necessarily the most objective source, but we can take them at their word that the insurgency of Yaqub Beg was a tool in the hands of Britain and Tsarist Russia, who wanted to split Xinjiang. It was the great game, and we understand that, you know, all of the peoples of this part of the world who were struggling for their local autonomy, all the way from the Caucasus Mountains to Mongolia, were unfortunately manipulated into the camp of one or another of the great powers during this period of the great game, when basically Russia, China, and Britain were sort of in this three-way contest for control of Central Asia. Well, today, really, the great game continues. And pretty much the U.S. has stepped into the role of Britain. And it's unfortunate that the Uyghurs and other peoples have been manipulated into the camp of one power or another, but they only did so because, you know, they were struggling for their own autonomy, and they were forced to seek friends wherever they could find them, on the basis of mutual enemies, right? That's how the great game has always worked. Let's see. We're almost getting to the half hour here. There was more that I wanted to say, but I'm probably going to have to wrap it up if we're really going to take listener phone calls. Although, I noticed that nobody is calling in, either because you're also completely wrapped with attention about my exegesis here, or because nobody's listening at all. So I guess we'll find out which quite shortly. But obviously, you know, once again, you know, the situation kind of goes both ways. And this is why I think that it's a fairly nuanced situation in terms of on one hand, the imperial rivalry between the U.S. and China, and on the other hand, the points of convergence between the U.S. and China, which is reflected in splits within the Uyghur dissident community themselves, between those who could be considered more sort of domesticated by the West and are at least willing to to play ball with the West. Here it was Rabia Kadir, who was the exiled Uyghur leader, who in fact did meet with George Bush back in 2007 at a conference in Prague. So on one hand, you know, the Uyghurs are still sort of a pawn in the great game, so to speak. On the other hand, obviously, there are these elements such as the ETIM, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, which, if the propaganda of the Chinese state, which is accepted by Washington and the Pentagon, is to be believed, have, embraced jihadism and Wahhabism and Islamic militancy generally. And there, you know, there would be a clear point of convergence between Washington and Beijing in terms of opposing that. And of course, we want to see we would like to support the elements amongst the Uyghurs who are who are actually resisting manipulation by the outside powers and are militantly independent, but probably, if the propaganda is to be believed, it's elements like the Etim, which are, you know, sort of embracing political Islam and Sharia law and would like to impose some kind of Taliban-type state, if the propaganda is to be believed. And I'm not sure that it is to be believed, but just giving it the benefit of the doubt for the moment. Whereas, you know, though it's the ones like Rabia Kadir, who is a woman, by the way, who was willing to meet with George Bush, who would support a more progressive and secular order in independent or at least autonomous Xinjiang or Uyghurstan. So there's a lot of contradictions here for us to grapple with. And I, once again, you know, I have to emphasize, I don't claim to have any answers. I'm just trying to start a conversation. I'm just trying to jumpstart a conversation and try to arrive at answers with you, the listener, rather than dictating to you, you know, the correct line. Because I don't have a correct line. I don't know the answers to these questions. I just know that they're very, very interesting questions, which nobody else seems to be asking. So, let's see. You know, I just also wanted to reiterate once again, because I know, you know, this, the whole Long Live the People's Republic of China crowd out there who seem to call in, and they seem to be getting their analysis about China almost exclusively from reading Workers' World, which, supports the crackdown in Tibet, supported the Tiananmen Square massacre back in 1989, and called the kids who were protesting in Tiananmen Square counter-revolutionaries. I would argue that exactly the opposite is the case. That it was in the 10 years subsequent to the Tiananmen Square massacre that foreign investment began pouring into China, and the China began started producing cheap export goods for the world market and for Walmart and so on. And that was, you know, it was at Tiananmen Square where the Chinese state proved that it was, you know, willing to be a good client for the capitalist powers and was not above killing its own populace in order to maintain order, which translates into a favorable investment climate. Okay? And similarly, the peasants who are now taking up arms against the security forces in order to protect their lands. Okay, now, you can't argue that they're backed by any outside power, because they're not even organized enough to be backed by any outside power. They're not involved in the great game, okay? They are completely a completely spontaneous, leaderless upsurge directly from the grassroots, okay? There isn't even any real, like, organization to it. Maybe just at the village level, certainly not even at the regional level, much less at the national level. These peasant uprisings which have been going on in China over land grabs and pollution for the past couple of years now. Okay. Now here, you know, one of the gains of the Chinese Revolution is that all land was nationalized. Private holding of land was completely outlawed in China. All land was nationalized, and peasants were guaranteed access to land. This is one of the gains of the Chinese Revolution. What's been happening over the past, at least the past 10 years, probably more, 15, 20 years, is that while this remains the case, that all land is, you know, controlled by the national government on paper, in reality, the land is being privatized through sleazy backdoor deals, and, McMansions are going up. And the land is turning into, you know, this sort of nouveau riche suburban kind of development for, you know, the new elites, which have made a lot of money off of the industrial boom. And the peasants are being kicked off of the land and being expropriated from the land. All right. That's the reality of what has happened. So, you know, the peasants who are taking up arms against the contemporary Chinese state are actually defending the gains of the Chinese Revolution. They're defending whatever remnants of the socialist system continue to exist in China. And the Chinese state is attempting to enforce a capitalist order. I mean, this is clear. This is so clear cut. And it's also quite clear cut that, you know, I mean, as we were discussing last week when we were talking about urban bicycle transportation and so on, that, you know, the cult of the private automobile is sort of becoming official in China. And now that finally, after years and years of protests, we're finally starting to get some bicycle lanes here in New York City. They're eliminating the bicycle lanes in Shanghai. You know, Mao, say what you want about Mao, he's being de-emphasized in the textbooks and in the, you know, official history and so on. And to the extent that he is glorified, it's for giving China the nuclear bomb, not for leading a peasants' revolution, not for giving land to the peasantry. All of that is just going down the Orwellian memory hole in China now. And, you know, there's the same kind of claims about sterilization abuse of the restive peasantry in China, just as exactly the same kind that you see in, you know, in Mexico and in Peru and so on. And it's, to me, you know, the situation is so clear. And, you know, in just in terms of talking about, you know, the alphabet soup of the, you know, leftist sectarian parties that we have to deal with on the left here in New York City, much as I disagree with the Revolutionary Communist Party, the RCP, about their abject glorification of Mao and Mao's latter-day emulators such as the Sendero Luminoso, much as I disagree with them about that, which is to say completely, I completely disagree with them about that, at least I will give them credit for recognizing that the contemporary Chinese state has completely betrayed Mao's legacy and that they hate the rulers of the contemporary Chinese state. And they recognize them as counter-revolutionaries. And they recognize that the people who Mao called the capitalist roaders, and remember, Deng Xiaoping was purged in the Cultural Revolution for being a capitalist roader. And then, you know, he assumed power in 1979 and put the so-called, you know, Gang of Four leaders of the Cultural Revolution on trial. Remember all that? The people that, that Mao called the capitalist roaders completely assumed power in the so-called revisionist coup of 1979. And at least the, you know, the Revolutionary Communist Party recognizes this, that there has been a capitalist coup d'etat in China and that China has not been communist since 1979. At least they recognize this. Whereas the Workers' World Party actually still wants us to believe that China is socialist. And if any of you people out there think that you can make the case that China is in any way socialist, I'd love to hear it, because I don't think that you've got any case whatsoever. And to the extent that it is, that there are surviving remnants of the socialist system, it's being defended by the rebel peasants who are taking up arms against the security forces in China. So, and if there's any basis of, you know, leftist support for the Chinese state, it's purely on the basis of, you know, that, you know, China is a competitive world power, a rival world power to the United States. So that's by supporting China's rise, at least we're, you know, supporting a multipolar world as opposed to the unipolar world where, you know, there's just one superpower. Okay, that's an argument. But you can't begin to argue that it's got anything to do with socialism versus capitalism. It's just two rival capitalist states. And yeah, maybe arguably it's better to have, you know, the world divided by several great power, great capitalist powers as opposed to just, you know, one great capitalist superpower which controls everything. Okay, that's a case. But don't pretend that it's got anything to do with socialism. Tell you what, we're going to take a very brief musical break. I went on too long. So people, please call in immediately, 212-209-2900, right after we Here we're going to play something abjectly corny. This is for all of you. This is for the Long Live the People's Republic of China crowd out there, taking the Wayback Machine to 1983. Hello? Oh, okay. The computer's not working. Well, in that case, you know what? I guess we'll just go straight to phone calls. I don't know why it's not working. That's really annoying. Let's try one more time. Yeah, here we go. Hopelessly corny. I couldn't resist. Okay, in terms of the music, we just, of course, went from the sublime to the ridiculous. That was the Red Rockers with their 1983 hit, China. And, boy, I wish you could have seen the images on the computer screen from their video, because they were profoundly embarrassing. As if the song isn't embarrassing enough. But okay, all right, now we're going to dive into the unknown and take some listener phone calls at 212-209-2900 in the 15 minutes remaining to us. And I just want to say, you know, I want some responses here to what I'm saying. I don't want to hear just, you know, sloganeering and long live the People's Republic of China. I'm just going to turn that down if that's all you've got to say. And I don't want to hear accusations that I'm on the CIA payroll, because I'm not on the CIA payroll, nor am I on the payroll of George Soros or any foundation. I am a struggling writer, okay? I live month to month on what I can eke out through freelance writing, my website, and selling my labor as a copy editor, okay? So, you know, I almost wish that I had the opportunity to sell out, but nobody's making any offers, okay? So there's no way that I'm on anybody's payroll, especially the CIA or George Soros. So spare me the red herrings. All I'm looking for is responses to my arguments, okay? And if you're not willing to give me that, then we're just going to, like, move on. Once again, the number is 212-209-2900. No sloganeering, no accusations that I'm on the CIA payroll, okay? Just responses. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, Amy Goodman's building is partly controlled by George Soros. Andrea Soros's daughter gives out money to the Tibet crowd. This is all childlike and juvenile, your attacks on China. You always attack real socialism. You're like a little...
Okay. You're making accusations. We said we're no accusations. I want responses. I want to hear an argument from you as to why you think that China is socialist.
12 cops invade the last LSB meeting. You understand?
What does that got to do with what we're talking about? Why is China socialist?
Freedom in China and Russia. You dragged 12 cops into the last LSB meeting.
I didn't do anything at the last LSB meeting. I haven't been to an LSB meeting in years, okay? So I didn't do anything at the LSB meeting, and we're not talking about the LSB, we're talking about China. Now, you're accusing me of, you know, attacking real socialism. I want an argument from you as to why China is socialist.
Come in, right? You talk about freedom, and you won't let somebody like me speak out.
What do you mean? I'm giving you every opportunity to speak, but you're not listening. You're just ranting incoherently. Can I get an argument out of you? This is your last chance.
You're incoherent. You hate socialism. You hate communism. You're an imperialist running dog. That's all you are. That's all you'll ever be. Why should anybody be nice to you?
I'm not asking you to be nice to me. I'm asking you to respond to my arguments.
Me? All your people, you have the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, busy there.
I don't get a dime from any of them. I don't get a dime from any of them.
Oh, you're playing games. Sidney Smith physically attacked me.
I'm not Sidney Smith.
That's what really happened. Do you understand that?
You're just discrediting yourself. Do you want to respond? I'm giving you an opportunity to talk, but you have to respond to what I said.
Free from Rush Limbaugh, your anti-communist shit. We can get free from Rush.
Okay, goodbye. I gave him a chance. He blew it. WBAI, you're on the air.
Good points, Bill, about more capitalist countries than just one competing to make the world maybe a better place.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello? Yes, hello. Hi.
Hi. Yep.
Hey, great. Well, I just wanted to commend you on providing us with this valuable information. I had a comment about the Uyghurs and one comment about Tompkins Square Park this past weekend. Uyghurs, is that how you pronounce it? Uyghurs?
Yep. U-I-G-H-U-R.
Well, it seems as if it's like a pro-Tibet type thing, if I'm not wrong. And if they attack like a police station and police and military type personnel, that means they were targeting non-combatants as opposed to non-combatant civilians, right? So that seems more fair than, say, like an actual terrorist attack, which is aimed at civilians. So if, you know, there's an independence movement in Tibet, then any apparatus or symbols state are fair game.
Or this wasn't Tibet, it was Uyghurstan, but your point is taken. What happened in Kunming, where they actually blew up buses, that was clearly a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
This was an attack on police. So arguably, you know, it wasn't an attack on civilians, so arguably you could say that it's not a terrorist attack.
you know, so that'll be interesting to keep following that story.
Definitely.
Anybody arguing that China is anything but an authoritarian, exploitative, repressive gulag is clearly on some drugs, which I have no access to. The thing I wanted to say about Tompkins Square Park, just noticed that the kids were having a lot of fun in the mosh pit, and there was a lot of energy. And it just, as I was standing there observing this, made me think, wow, wouldn't it be great if this could be directed toward revolutionary purposes? And so I came up with this formula, like E for energy times M for mass, E times M equals, plus S for strategy, equals R for revolution, or at least revolutionary actions. So, hey, this is just war cry checking in with my 2 cents.
Okay,
thank
you,
for letting me do that.
Yep. WBAI, you're on the air. 212-209-2900 is the number. Please turn down your radio first. You're on the air. Hello? No, you're not turning down the radio.
Yeah, hello, Bill?
Yeah.
The point is that Paul Rienzo posted on listenerforums.net and showed the park, Tompkins
Square Park. What does this have to do with what we're talking about? WBAI, you're on. This is why I don't take listener phone calls. I mean, what a disaster. Warcry was the only one who had anything intelligent to say so far. 212-209-2900. Is there anybody who has something to say about what we're discussing tonight? WBAI, you're on the air.
Have you always been boring?
WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes, you said that you wanted to hear arguments about why China is socialist. It was a product in 1949 of a proletarian revolution. That's what created the state there.
Okay, hang on. You don't think that that revolution was completely overturned in 1979?
Oh, no.
Why not? Given everything which is going on in China today, given that the peasants are being usurped of their lands, given that the workers are being are losing their basic rights and are working in these so-called illegal factories where there's no minimum wage, no labor standards, et cetera, given that hear me out and then you'll get a chance to reply, okay? Given that Given that in the prelude to the Olympics, working class districts were cleared out in Beijing, and local shops and working class communities were cleared out to make way for this big garish Olympic village, exactly as happened when they built Lincoln Center here in New York City. Given that the poor have been pushed into shanty towns in the cities of the industrial north in China, particularly around Manchuria. I mean, given all of this, given that you can go into Walmart and buy these cheap goods made by de facto slave labor in China, as human rights account after human rights account is documented, on what basis do you argue that China is anything other than oppressively capitalist today? Now, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, look, I mean, I just start to speak. You already spoke so long. You admitted that you spoke too long, so that you're cramping out the call-in time. Now you speak again, so you want to hear arguments. You start. Somebody starts.
All right, you're still not responding to what I said.
Right. Okay. Now as I pointed out, in 1949 was the proletarian revolution in China. I don't know if you dispute that. That's what the state currently is a product of.
Oh, right. You now, just said that. I just responded.
They desperately need to industrialize China. They desperately need to increase labor productivity in order to be able to make inroads against the poverty that was based on the backwardness of China. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. The backwardness of China, and they tried the Great Leap Forward, they tried the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. Neither one of them was able to squeeze enough out of the local population, the domestic population, in order to industrialize the country and improve people's lives. So they decided to make an opening to the West to do it on the basis of Western investment. And actually, in the you know, you talk as if the standard of living in China were going down, as if the longevity of people were going down. Even in Tibet, the longevity of the people has improved from 35, but the average lifespan in China, to 65 currently.
Yes, but there are huge sectors of the population for whom things are getting much, much worse. For much of the peasantry and for much of the, I would say, former disenfranchised industrial proletariat, things are getting much, much worse.
The standard of living in China is going up. I don't think anybody disputes that. And a lot of it is because of this this policy
You think it's a good thing that there? You think it's a good thing that there are shanty towns in China today?
Oh, it's a terrible thing.
Right.
I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it's a legacy of history that that the Chinese are struggling to overcome. It's going to take a long time.
But there weren't shanty towns in China. There weren't shanty towns in China under Mao. Say what you want about him. There weren't shanty towns in China under Mao. It's only been in the last 20 years that you've got shanty towns in China.
But China wants to become look. The overall standard of living has increased tremendously in the last 20 years in China. So
but not equally. You used a very telling phrase, squeeze out of the population. That's the phrase you used. It's exactly, you know, the way capitalists talk. And that's exactly what they've done. They've squeezed, you know, a greater standard of living for the new bourgeoisie off the backs of the peasants and the workers. That's exactly what they've done.
Whether you're a bourgeoisie or the proletariat, you have to set aside a part of your production that you don't consume if you want to add to your productive forces. And so if you want to look at it, is squeezing it out of yourself, or however you want to put it, it amounts to having to work very hard in order to be able to have your own consumption. And also to be able to.
All right. So, what do you have to say? What do you have to say about the East Turkestan Islamic movement? Do you support the U.S. holding these Uyghurs in Guantanamo Bay on the basis of the Chinese state's intelligence?
The U.S. holding anyone? The U.S. is the biggest imperialist power in the world.
Ah, right. But you're not answering the question. In this particular case, the U.S. is holding these people in Guantanamo Bay entirely on the basis of intelligence from the Chinese government.
It's the same as a lot of the people from other sections of Al-Qaeda. That was largely pulled together by the U.S. to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. Later on, some of them, to some degree, turned on the imperialists. They created the Frankenstein, and they're in a conflict with that. But even there, they're fighting for self-determination of their region of the world against imperialism.
So you support the Uyghurs and you support the East Turkestan Islamic movement.
No, I don't. I don't support it against China is not an imperialist power. China is not what the United States is. Even if it were, I would say that as an American living in the United States, I would have to oppose primarily my own imperialism and not try to make inroads against other countries that are targeted through various secessionist movements.
I'm not trying to make inroads. I'm trying to apply the same principles consistently, that if people are entitled to their self-determination in East Timor or Afghanistan or Iraq, they're entitled to their self-determination in Xinjiang.
Just like when this country was at another stage of its development, the British supported the South when it seceded from the United States. They thought that would be a way that they could weaken the new rival and get back in. And to some degree, they did. Now, the point is that that's what the U.S. is doing in China. They don't give a damn about the Uyghurs or the Tibetans.
But we're not talking, hang on a minute, we're not talking about U.S. intentions. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about whether the Uyghurs have a right to self-determination.
I would say that in the abstract, they do, but right now it's a question of China's self-determination against an imperialist power that wants to...
But we're not talking about China's self-determination against an imperialist power, but against the indigenous people of Uyghurstan.
Under the current conditions, the Uyghurs are a tool of U.S. imperialism.
Okay, if they're a tool of U.S. imperialism, why are they being detained at Guantanamo Bay?
That's another sector of them.
No, it's the same sector, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, the very same group which the Chinese are you know, instrumenting this crackdown again in the name of crushing in Uyghurstan, is the very same group that the U.S. is saying with these people detained at Guantanamo Bay are members of. Exactly the same group.
It's a contradictory movement, and in one part of the world it's fighting the U.S., and in another part of the world it's a tool of the U.S. It's a contradictory movement. Whose policies are being manipulated.
So in other words, you support the ETIM when they're in Afghanistan fighting the U.S., but you oppose them when they're in their own country fighting China.
I don't exactly support them, meaning that that I agree with the policies that they propose and everything else.
So what do you propose happened to those people in who are being held in Guantanamo? You think that they should be released to China? That it's oppressive that they're being held in Guantanamo, but release them to China so they can be held and tortured in China instead of being held and tortured in Guantanamo, and that's okay? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think that the Uyghur people in China, as Tibetan people in China, have had tremendous improvements in their standard of living since the revolution.
Then why are they taking up arms and why are they protesting? And but you didn't answer the question, by the way. You didn't answer. You completely dodged the question. What do you think should happen to those Uyghurs who are being held at Guantanamo?
I'm against Guantanamo. I'm against the U.S.
What do you think should happen to those Uyghurs who are being held at Guantanamo? Do you think they should be released to China?
I think they should be. I'm against the U.S. holding them. And
that's not. Yeah, but why do you think they should be released to China? You're dodging the question.
I don't want the U.S. to control how where they're released to. I don't. The U.S. kidnapped those people, and it has no right to control where they go.
All right, you're completely dodging the question. They have to be released to somewhere. If you're going to be calling for their release, they have to be released to somewhere.
Okay, so let them go where they want. I don't know. We're supposed to be talking about China at this point. You're trying to shift it over to the U.S. Guantanamo.
It's not a distraction. What are you talking about? A distraction is what the whole program has been about. It's not a distraction. All right, we're going to see if we can squeeze in one. No, we can't. It's 1:30. Too bad. All right, maybe we'll continue this some other time. Let's go out with a little bit more. Let's go out with a little bit more music from the Buryat and Mongol peoples. And in spite of all the contradictions. Solidarity.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.